Hello, my name is Philip Merton, and today we are going to have a conversation beyond science and religion.
Breaking new ground in thinking, exploring the outer limits of what we know about the world and ourselves, unhindered by common beliefs and perceptions. This is Conversations Beyond Science and Religion, taking on subjects from the Big Bang, the multiverse, and evolution, to the supernatural and the new rising consciousness. This is where scientists, philosophers, New Agers, and spiritualists come together to discuss where this world may be heading. Now, here's your host, lawyer, philosopher, and the author of The Heaven at the End of Science, Philip Merton.
Now, the purpose of this show is to explore the outer limits of science and spirituality, to explore what's new in the realms of science and spirituality, but to also bring these concepts down to earth so that we can make better sense of the world we live in. Now, one of the features of our modern world is that we tend to categorize religion and science into different boxes, different books on the shelves, different buildings on the street. We tend to categorize and label religions as well. We put, for example, Western religions such as Christianity, Islam, and Judaism into one box on the shelf, and we put maybe Eastern religions or philosophies such as Hinduism, Taoism, and Buddhism in different boxes. And when we think about the Eastern religions from a Western mindset, we tend to maybe cloak them with myth. We view them as something in a different world that has no meaning to the Western mind. This may not be true, though. It turns out that in the Western world, there are many celebrities, for example, that are actually Buddhists. For example, Richard Gere, and then there's Jennifer Lopez and Goldie Hawn, and Steven Seagal. And of course, the Dalai Lama is perhaps the world's most famous Buddhist. So when we ignore these principles, these Eastern religious principles such as Buddhism, we may be ignoring something important to us, something that may give us more meaning. Now, the story of the Buddha is the story of the Enlightened One. And we've used the terms of Buddhism in our daily lives, in our modern culture, probably without knowing what they mean. For example, many of us have used the term nirvana to probably mean some kind of state of ecstasy. We've used the word karma. And then we all have heard of reincarnation, perhaps the wheel of rebirth, the Four Noble Truths, the Eightfold Path. But what do all these terms really mean? In many ways, our modern world cloaks this story of the Buddha in myth. But is there a way to make this story more real to us in the Western world? Does Buddhism have anything to say to the modern mind? And that is our conversation today. Now, joining me in this conversation today is John Cian Chiosi, who was born in Italy and educated in Australia. In 1972, he was ordained as a Buddhist monk in Thailand and trained under one of Thailand's most gifted and influential meditation masters, the late Venerable Ajahn Chah. In 1982, he was asked to go and help establish a Buddhist monastery in Perth, Western Australia. For the next 14 years, he was instrumental in successfully establishing a Buddhist monastery and Buddhist center in that area of Australia. During this time, he served as abbot and spiritual director of the Buddhist Society of Western Australia, being responsible for the training of monks and the teaching of the lay community. His gift for presenting profound teachings in a clear and pragmatic style inspired a great number of people, not only in Australia, but internationally. In 1995, he left the monastic life and moved to Chicago, Illinois, where he continues to share his insights and wisdom as a lecturer at the College of DuPage and the Theosophical Society in America. Now, he is author of two books, one called True Freedom, published by the Buddha Dharma Foundation in Bangkok, and the other, The Meditative Path, published by Quest Books, both of which I believe are available on Amazon.com. Now, thank you for joining us, John. Welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you for having me, Philip. I'm very happy to be talking with you.
Okay, well, let's first get started with some foundational questions. And first of all, what in your mind are the key distinctions between Buddhism and the Western religions, and particularly Christianity?
I would say that maybe the requirements. Christianity, as many of the other theistic religions, are pretty much based on the need for belief, and the faith is almost a requirement. Whereas Buddhism is not based on that requirement. Buddhism very much is presenting a series of questions and answers regarding the nature of life based on the teachings of the Buddha, and it invites the individual to investigate and put these teachings to a test in order to arrive at one's own preference as to whether one feels these teachings are relevant, effective in providing the desired results of happiness. And if they are, then one has confidence in following that path. So it doesn't start with the requirement of belief. The other difference is in the nature of practice. Buddhism has a very strong emphasis on the importance of meditation and introspection and the need to arrive at an understanding of oneself rather than pointing to the world out there or to, say, a god or a supernatural being that we have to look to. So Buddhism points inwards to oneself and encourages oneself to seek for understanding and has confidence in the individual to arrive at this understanding if pointed out, it points it in the right direction. So that, I'd say that there.
So one of the features of Buddhism that I think is appealing to many people, if I understand it correctly, is that there really isn't an intermediary between the individual and, let's just call it, the ground of being, for the lack of a better term. In the Western religions, God is viewed as separate, or I think that is correct. God is viewed as separate, whether we call it Jesus Christ or some God in the sky, in the heavens. Whereas, as you point out, Buddhism looks inward, and it's a personal journey. Is that accurate, or how would you frame the point that I'm trying to make here?
Well, I'd probably say it in a slightly different way. I'd say that Buddhism emphasizes that there is an ultimate reality, or the truth. The truth is something that, by saying the, it's singular. So it cannot belong to any one tradition or any one religion. It's just the truth. Furthermore, that this truth is something that is, regardless of whether anybody knows it or doesn't know it, realizes or doesn't realize it, and that this truth can be realized by individuals. And there is a system of training, or there is a path available by which individuals can come to this realization. The intermediary need of a God to give grace is not seen as something necessary, or a God, all-powerful, all-knowing, the Creator. That doesn't, in Buddhism, that does not really fit into the scheme of the reality. Buddhism talks about gods, but they are seen as just other beings in the realm of existence. They are maybe of a different form and a different nature, into the extent that they're much more refined celestial beings. And Buddhism uses, very much like the Hindu cosmology, many levels of heavens and many levels of hells. But as to whether these planes of existence can be, experienced or not externally, they certainly refer to states of mind that we do experience. So Buddhism, excuse me, doesn't put much emphasis on the need for an external entity to either guide us or to teach us or to give us grace. Buddhism really puts the human being at the forefront of the spiritual path. We do have grace. We have the ability to think. We have the ability to investigate. We have the ability to arrive at insight. What we need is training. And the Buddha, unlike some people who consider him as the Buddhist god, the Buddha never claimed to be a god. He was a human being, but an extraordinary human being to the extent that he actually realized his full potential. That is, he became enlightened. As a human being, he became an enlightened human being. And then what he did was to simply teach how he did it and how others can do it and realize exactly what he had realized. So that's the main difference there.
Yeah, I think you said something very important here, where somebody like the Buddha is viewed, I think, in the Western mind, because we are conditioned to view these founders of religion as gods or channelers of God, in the case of maybe Muhammad in Islam, that the Buddha was a normal human being who experienced this enlightenment, which we're going to unpack a little bit in a moment. But I think it's very important for everyone to understand that this is a journey that is available for everybody, right? It's not like for a special few. If anybody wants to sort of walk that path that the Buddha began, and maybe we need to update a little bit, but that path, then anybody can experience this enlightenment, as you say, with the right training, the right discipline. It's not for a privileged few, right? It's not for those who, you know, read the sacred text or pray or go to church once a week or pay homage to some other divinity, right? It's a very personal journey that's available for anybody. Correct?
I'd agree with that. Yes.
Yeah, and so go ahead.
Right. The teachings of the Buddha are universal. He did not have a teaching that was in any way esoteric to the extent that it was only to the privileged few. And he didn't have a chosen people. I mean, he saw the family of humanity. Every human being, every living being has the potential, but certainly every human being, regardless of status or regardless of sex, has the potential and the capacity to realize this truth. And when he taught the path to arrive at this realization, it is something that is very immediate, relevant, and can be practiced by everybody.
Yeah, I think before we talk about the Buddha's enlightenment, I want to try to draw a sharp contrast between the way of the Buddha and the way of Jesus Christ. Okay, and there are books. In fact, I think I have one on my bookshelf that compares Jesus Christ, Socrates, and the Buddha, and finding how they were similar or dissimilar, however you look at it. But can you in your own words, maybe using Jesus Christ and the Buddha as a contrast, try to articulate what the difference is between following the way of the Buddha and following the way of Jesus Christ. There probably are some similarities, but you may have already touched upon them, but I think it's important to sharpen that contrast, if you can try that.
That sounds like a minefield.
Well, I could try it if you want. Why don't you go? Do you want me to try?
Go ahead. The best way we can do it, maybe, Philip, is if you bring up, although I was raised a Catholic, I don't feel that I'm really that well-versed in, I'm probably as well-versed as ordinary Christians about Christianity, but that may not be doing Christianity justice, because the majority of people has such a superficial understanding of Christianity. So when we want to, say, compare Buddhism to Christianity or the Buddha to Jesus, you see, my experience of Buddhism and my knowledge of Buddhism and my relation to the Buddha's teaching is at a quite a sophisticated and deep personal level that, whereas with Christianity and Jesus, to me, all it is a pretty superficial religion. And I would say it's kind of an immature understanding of Christianity, because I have met Christians who do seem to have a much deeper appreciation and interpretation of both Jesus and his teachings than I learned as a young man,
yeah,
and that I was aware of.
Yeah. Well, I would say, and maybe it was an unfair question, but what the heck, I'm the host, I could ask these questions. But one contrast that I would say to put it in my own words is that many followers of Christianity, and there's nothing wrong with Christianity, I'm not criticizing it, but they tend to view Jesus as the God on the cross and want Jesus Christ to drag him or her into a better world through worship, where you're sort of externalizing this religious drive, whereas in Buddhism you're looking inside for your own path. It's a deeply personal search, and you're realizing that everything you need to accomplish enlightenment or the kingdom of heaven inside is within you. And so in some ways, I mean, I do think Christianity and Buddhism overlap to a degree if you look at the words of Jesus Christ as opposed to maybe the teachings of Orthodox religion. But I think it's important to understand that a Christian could practice Buddhism. In other words, there's no application you have to fill out. There's no, gospel or baptism. If a Christian wants to try to find the path of Buddhism, then he or she can do it and maybe suspend their other beliefs for a while, but they're not necessarily incompatible. In my mind, but I think that the sharp contrast that I see, I think you've already said it, that I think is important, is that Buddhism is an internal path, and that's why the meditation is such an important feature of it, and that's the way I would put it.
It sounds quite reasonable. I mean, there are obvious in the realm of if one looks at in the realm of a good life, or what we call morality or virtue, then you will probably find a lot of similarities between what constitutes virtue and morality in Christianity and in Buddhism, and possibly in most of the world religions. And it can be summarized as to not doing of anything that is bad or evil, and doing that which is generally accepted as good or beneficial.
Right.
But then there are, and you've already indicated, there are some subtle differences. I mean, Jesus had to die on the cross in order to remove this original flaw in us, sacrifice himself to enable us to become or to have the opportunity to enter heaven. I mean, that's quite foreign to Buddhism. We don't talk about an original sin. In fact, we in Buddhism tend to say that the mind, in its more fundamental state, is quite radiant and quite pure. It becomes clouded and by the defilements or by the ideas and false concepts that arise in it. So it doesn't start from the same place. And also, I agree with you, it does not require that some external agent work for us and make it possible for us to become worthy or enlightened or free, it does point to us, and it really does, you know, in many ways, just respect the human being. It really empowers the human being. We are not just victims. We don't require some external agent to do it for us, or we don't have to wait for an external agent to, allow us. All it requires is that we realize our potential and put forth some intelligent effort in order to arrive at the goal. So it does put the human being in a very preeminent position, if you wish. It really respects the capacity and the potential of the human being. And as a Buddhist, one feels very empowered that I am responsible for my life and what I create in this life, and not in a selfish way, but in an understanding that there are consequences from the universal laws, that the way I live will have results. And I am responsible for attaining my liberation or my enlightenment. And it is not, I don't feel victim, and I don't feel at the mercy of any external agent at all.
Yeah, and from what you've just said, I think that you could see that a lot of the New Age or New Spirituality writers are taking parts of Buddhism and articulating them in different words. For example, there's Eckhart Tolle, who in the book The New Earth has, and you probably have read some or all of his books, where he picks up parts of Buddhism and uses them to develop his own thinking. Many New Age writers repeat the mantra that we're all responsible for creating our own reality. Thoughts create reality. Look inside for the deeper truth. And not that they're not citing to Buddhism, but these beliefs and principles of Buddhism, I think, permeate our society more than we think they do. and that's what we're going to be getting into in a couple minutes. I just want to close the loop on something which is this question of God. And we know from Hinduism that the God of Hinduism, at least from the spiritual standpoint, is Brahma or Brahman, the united self or the ground of being. And where does the concept of God, the spiritual God, fit into Buddhism, if anywhere?
Well, Buddhist cosmology, as I said, has all these different realms of existence, and it does include the Brahma realm, and Brahma gods are, in the highest realms of refinement, if you wish, of the, heavenly planes. But they are never considered as permanent. There's no god, no state, no being in Buddhism that is considered either permanent or all-powerful or all-knowing. And certainly there is no god the creator, god the punisher, and god the rewarder in Buddhism. Those concepts are filled by other things in Buddhism, and we call them universal laws, if you wish, or just very impersonal laws explain how existence operates. It's not due to a god doing anything. Even those gods, and Brahma, or the Christian god, or any god, any being, any living being, anything in existence, exists within these laws. And so these are impersonal laws. For instance, the law of karma, one could say, is the Buddhist explanation that in Christianity and maybe in other theistic religions, is God rewarding and punishing. The law of conditioned arising, which is another aspect, you know, much broader aspect of the way things come about, is conditioned by causes, many causes. And this has no first beginning and no end. And so that would take the place of God creating and God destroying and the beginning of the universe or all of that. So that is a very big difference. In God, in Buddhism, we just do not have a God that exists outside of this, this, if you wish, this sphere of existence. Because if you say, well, like we say, God created the world, or God created existence, then, you know, you're putting God outside of creation. And so Buddhism doesn't do that. There is nothing outside of creation, but there is the escape from duality and the escape from the conditioned existence, and that is called nirvana.
Yeah, the issue about between the self and God is, I think, a big one. To me, as a matter of logic, if you hold the view that reality is one, and in the most simple terms, I understand that the Eastern religions believe that reality is one, that there's a unity to reality. Now, if you hold that principle, then by necessity, there cannot be a God external to the one. God must be the one. If you're going to call anything God, then it must be the one. And that's that thought that I just said is really the perennial, I think that's the perennial philosophy. I think that's Hinduism. I think it's related to Buddhism, where it's internal. It cannot be external. And to have a quick link to modern science for a moment here, we've had many discussions on this show about quantum physics and about consciousness and this whole question about, well, what role does consciousness form have in formulating, creating, assembling the external world? And then you've got some people like Amit Goswami, who believes that it's all consciousness, and therefore, do we begin to see a convergence here between modern science and Eastern religions? And that's a whole other topic. But we start going down this path where, as a matter of logic, if all is one, God cannot be outside the one. God must be the one. And then you start paging through some books in quantum physics, and you start saying, well, maybe there is a convergence coming down the road here. It may take centuries, generations, whatever, but I think it's important for the modern mind to understand that in many ways some of these disciplines are saying the same thing with different language. Now, let's talk about Buddha under the tree and his enlightenment. Because we use the word enlightenment, everyone wants to be enlightened. And we use that term in so many different ways in modern culture. Let's talk about what enlightenment the Buddha had under the tree, assuming there was a tree. Maybe it's all part of the myth. You know, maybe if you read, apparently we don't really know much about his life, but why don't you describe what you understand his enlightenment to be and how he got there?
The actual historical facts of where he was sitting or exactly what night it happened is not so important. It does say that he left his home at the age of 29 and for 6 years practiced various forms of asceticism and practices that were common amongst the recluses and ascetics of the Ganges Valley at that time, and eventually set off on his own and cultivated very deep states of meditation. Now, many people, you know, just have some experience of meditation, but few people can arrive at really deep states of meditation because we don't practice it with the same degree of intensity and commitment. But Siddhartha did. I mean, he did, but that was his life. That's what he was doing. And he was able to arrive at deep states of absorption. Now, even though these, we may not know what they are from direct experience, but it suffices to say that once the mind can be trained to arrive at a state of stillness and clarity and focus, whereby it is no longer under the influence of any of what we would say defilements, or it transcends the any negative tendency, transcends this discursive thinking mind. It's beyond thinking. It's beyond conceptual. So it's just a very, for a start, a very refined state of concentration, a very refined state of clarity, a very refined state of stillness and silence of being rather than thinking about. Now, the Buddha was skilled at that. He practiced and attained very, very good mastery over his mind, so that he was, you can say, sharp and clear like a diamond. Now, with that refinement of mind, he was able to arrive at an experience of reality, the way things are, that you can't arrive at by thinking about them, speculating about them. It's got nothing to do with believing. And as I said earlier in our conversation, if there is a truth or the truth, you know, it's just the way things are. There's fundamental truth of reality is there. And the mind that is refined and clear and penetrating and directed at seeing it, realizes that truth, has a direct experience of it. So we can say that the Buddha's enlightenment was this experiencing of the truth or a reality as a result of his mind being so crystal clear, focused, and able to penetrate all the conceptual layers that we normally take for granted. So he had this experience. Now, what exactly it is? We cannot know it because we have to have that experience ourselves. Right. But what we can say is it transforms. It is a radical transformation that takes place in the human being, in one's view, in one's attitude, in one's understanding, in one's relation to oneself and the world. And the best way to describe it is that it completely frees the mind from all ignorance and delusion regarding reality, because one has had a direct experience of that reality. Two, it frees the mind from all forms of personal identification as a separate entity from others. Any sense of ego or personal permanent self disappears. And therefore, any sense of craving based on an ego center is no longer there. Any form of fear based on an ego center is no longer there. Any form of anger or aversion based on an ego center is no longer there. So the Buddha describes the realization as having this result on the individual, that it frees that mind from greed, hatred, and delusion. And that person, we can say, is transformed, is definitely still human, living in the body, but no longer under the power of anything in this world.
Yeah, first of all, that was a very good description, and I thought it was very helpful. I think it's important for you to define what you mean by ego center. And I know some of these other writers, such as Eckhart Tolle, uses the term ego as some sort of evil state. It sounds like a bad thing, and maybe it is a bad thing. But what do you mean? But what do you mean by ego center?
Well, what I mean that that there is in all of us, you know, language itself.
Right.
For a start, just language is based on I, in the sense that it always makes reference to a subject, and there's the object, the out there, me as the center, the world out there, me, you. Then our senses, our physical senses. So the way we think is based on that subject and object duality. And our senses also reinforce that because, you know, the way we experience the world is through our senses. And it always seems that the world is out there and I'm in here and I am the subject and either the recipient or the doer of things. So it is based on that. Now, when I say freeing the mind from that ego center, it means that the experience is such where there is this radical transformation of the way the world, if you wish, or the self or reality is seen, where that ego center, that subjective center that is considered me, is no longer there. Because it's just not evil, but it's a misconception or a distorted view, a wrong view of reality. So it's not that the ego or the self is, I mean, it can be evil or it can be good, but it's just a wrong view. It's just that we don't see it in the right way.
Okay, let me. Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead, John.
I was just going to say that in enlightenment, the experience of enlightenment or the realization of the way things are is usually called knowledge and vision of the way things really are. So what that means is that direct insight of reality frees the mind from that wrong view about the way things are. And so the wrong view is the ego center, that we view the world and ourselves from this center of self, an ego as existing independently or separately and a permanent aspect to it, very personal. And the realization frees us from that misconception.
Okay, now this is where I may part company with the Buddhist teaching, and I'm going to try to articulate that to see whether my own view is different. And that is that there is this interpretation that might be the right interpretation. It says, okay, well, you meditate, you realize that the self is illusory. We are actually part of a unified reality, part of this stream of becoming, and that therefore our attachment to the self is wrong, is an improper perspective, and that we are actually forms being attached onto this wheel of rebirth going around and around, and we'll get into the rebirth in a moment. What I think is the better interpretation, or my own interpretation, is that the self has to realize that it is part of the one, or part of a unified ground of being, and then with that attitude, with that mindset, now carry on your life as an individual. See, and so the many realizes it is one, and then the many with the mindset, with this global mindset, then carries on with a greater compassion. See, now that, and I don't know whether what I just said is different than what you think or what different from Buddhism, but I don't like it when you sort of stop at melting the self into the one, and then the question is, well, what is this body supposed to do? You know, wither away and just hang out, you know, so... So, anyways, I don't know if you could comment upon what I just said, but that's really...
Well, What I would say is that it's not very, I mean, it is intellectually interesting, and it's worthwhile having these sort of discussion with or raising these sort of questions. But I would rather, I would say that the experience cannot be arrived at through thinking, and these are just different ways of thinking about it. And so exactly what that realization is, I mean, the Buddha put it in certain, he said it's the realizing of the unsatisfactory nature, realizing of the impermanent nature and the not-self nature of all existence. And exactly what the reality is, though, is something that must be experienced each for oneself. And it can never be arrived at through concept or thinking, or intelligence is thinking about it, and it can never arrive at that experience. Whatever we think, it's something else. However, as to the second part of what you said, is what would be the consequence of having that realization and that experience? I mean, how would one live? Well, we have many examples of that. Is how did the Buddha live? How do enlightened, or we don't know whether people are completely enlightened, but certainly we have examples of many people who've been practicing for a long time, and we consider them to be very spiritually advanced. How do they live? And we do see that it's once you take away the greed, hatred, and delusion, fear, and preoccupation with the self center. How do you think that the radiant mind, just the natural outflow of that mind is compassion? Why? Because, I mean, we interpret it as compassion, but really all it is the natural outflow of a mind without the impediments of an ego center, or the impediments of self concern, the impediments of self-protection and self-investments. So that mind is free and from those impediments, and the way it flows in life, as we see from the example of many spiritual people, is a very beautiful outflowing of what we interpret as generous, compassionate, kind, loving human beings.
Yeah,
The Buddha was an example of that.
Yeah, and I think that's very well put, because this revelatory experience, and I'm using that for a lack of a better description, but this internal journey, let's say without the intellect, where you experience it, it's sort of like you've been to a place. You've had this rise in consciousness that will never leave, because you've been to that place and you know what it's like, and it's something that's hard to articulate, as we know from many writers in this area. And so that's sort of this attitude that you have going forward. And I think, when you said that it's a natural state of the one consciousness, it's not something that you say, okay, well, today I'm going to be a better person because people will like me more. Maybe that's another way to be a good person, but you're saying something a lot different. You're saying that when you look deeply inside and touch this ground of being, this truth, this law, that it's a more of a natural outgrowth of what this ground is in itself. Right.
That's the difference between one who is on the path and one who's completed the path. The full experience of enlightenment, so that what had to be done has been done. That means there's no more trying, no more doing, nothing to be developed, nothing to be gained, nothing to be abandoned. And that's why we say that being is free. Such as the Buddha. So it's not. And what often, though, the misunderstanding is that because ordinary people feel that our ability to be motivated, our ability to do and create requires, you know, some form of self-interest or greed or aversion. You know, so we feel that these are what motivate and enable us to create and shape and bring things into the world. And that's a lot of the reasoning to support things like capitalism. When you've got self-interest, you really make an effort. It's true.
Right.
Greed, aversion, anger, fear are very strong motivators. But they're not positive motivators necessarily, and they're not enlightened motivators. They're quite often blind.
Right.
And but now, what happens if you remove all of these, as I said, all these impediments? And what people have difficulty in understanding is that the freed mind can still act, can still manifest responses to life situations. And people, like, I'll give you an example. People say things like, well, if the Buddha or an enlightened person is not afraid of dying, why do they get out of the way when a bus is coming towards them?
Right.
And I say, well, why shouldn't they get out of the way?
Yeah, yeah,
I mean,
yeah.
What you're assuming something.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So the pure mind and has no, so it is able to respond in what we would say is a perfectly natural, that which is the most natural way to life. And the most natural way, when there is no impediment, self-interest and self-concern and fear, we, from the example of enlightened ones, can infer that it is this compassionate, what we interpret as compassionate living. It's only us interpreting it. For the enlightened one, it's just a natural outflow from the pure, radiant mind.
One of the truths, I think, of the Eastern perspective is that if you have this experience or this series of experiences, these higher levels of consciousness, it's something that's real to you, and it's something that you know is real. Now maybe you will not be able to prove it scientifically, but it's something that will never leave you, and so it's like a permanent attitude changer. So
correct.
So
that is if it is a true experience of reality, which we would say is an enlightening or penetrating insight, which would be an enlightenment experience. It is not something. It is transformative. It is. It's a radical shift. It's a radical transformation of the view, the way, the view of oneself and the world. And it is not something that you need to try and remember. It's just something has fallen away, and once it's fallen away, that's it. It's not like you're trying to remember what you learned from
you know,
school or something like that. However, I think it's worth noting that, you know, we are talking about very refined, anything that's so refined, there are such a range of experiences that people have, and it is not uncommon that in this refined area, there are experiences that are sometimes misinterpreted or misunderstood. And there are many people who may think they're enlightened or have had an enlightening experience, and maybe it was not. So there is certainly room for misunderstanding of something that is out of the ordinary. And that is why, you know, having an experienced good friend, we call them, or a teacher or a master or somebody who's, you know, quite experienced in that area of spiritual evolution is very beneficial, because it is, you know, it's like you're trying to climb Mount Everest. You know, it's very helpful to have somebody who kind of knows the way.
Yeah. I think that's a great observation. Now, I want to talk about nirvana, because nirvana is of all the principles of Buddhism, in my mind, I think if you do a Google search for the word Nirvana, it is used for so many different things, including the name of a rock band. It's called. I mean, it's
a hair salon. Nirvana.
hair salon. and it's, you know, it's also, I think, sometimes sort of compared to heaven or a state of enlightenment, but actually, Nirvana in Buddhism is a little different. Why don't you give a, if it's possible, a quick description of how you interpret Nirvana in Buddhism.
Okay, now that you will probably, you're quite accurate. It is one of the more, that together with the teaching of not self, are two of the most difficult, we can say, because to us they are concepts, so I'll say concepts. They are very difficult for us to come to terms to, or to arrive at a correct understanding through thought, because obviously it can't be done. You just cannot arrive at an understanding of what these things are through thought. So the process of describing or pointing is only useful to the extent that it may help us to at least look in the right direction. Now, Nirvana, you know, there are many different occasions throughout the Buddha's life where he makes reference to the word Nirvana. And one of the most useful, I think, one of the most useful definitions or descriptions of it is one that I've already given to you, that Nirvana is the complete eradication or the complete elimination of greed, hatred, and delusion. That is Nirvana. So in the term of you know, what the experience results in a human being is the complete eradication of all greed, hatred, and delusion. So that is a very practical thing then, because it at least says, well, we can recognize that in some way the enlightened being, it's not that they've attained and gained something more, it's that they've got something less than us. We have greed, hatred, and delusion. They don't have that.
Yes.
And so it's the freedom from this stuff. So that's at a level which is practical. However, the next question arises as to Nirvana as, the Buddha refers to it in regards to what he calls the unconditioned, the unborn, the undying, unoriginated. And he does say there is the unborn, the unconditioned, the unoriginated, where there is no being, no arising and no passing, no birth and no death. So he affirms this, and he also calls it the highest happiness. Now, the problem is that these translations, these renderings in English of the language that the Buddha may have spoken in 2,500 years ago in northern India, it can be sometimes a little off. Now, exactly what the Buddha's words were, and if we think of the language Pali, which, although it's not certain that is what the Buddha spoke, but it's probably similar or derivative of what the Buddha spoke in the Ganges Valley. Those words can be translated in a little different. Instead of saying Nirvana is the highest happiness, maybe it means Nirvana is the only happiness. And instead of saying there is an unborn, maybe it means there is no being born, or where there is no birth. So rather than it taking it, we'd like to take it in an affirmative tone.
Right.
Nirvana is actually, because once you say there is an unborn, unoriginated, it's implying there is something.
Yes. Yeah,
well, and as soon as you do that, you're pointing to something, and that's where the problem arises.
Well, the
we
classic.
Can probably,
oh, yes. I was gonna say the classic interpretation of Nirvana, or not maybe not the classic, but one of them that I read about and was taught, is the concept that after you understand that your attachment to the external world and yourself is false, and you go into the self and you realize the unity with the truth, that what you see is that there's a stream of becoming, and that all things are impermanent, all things outside are impermanent, that all that we have inside is a river flow. There's a river flowing, and our job is to create better karma, to live better lives, to positively affect, influence a new self, a new form that gets attached onto the wheel of rebirth. And so we go around and around and around with karma supposedly increasing and improving the self, but all you ever see is when you go inside is this river flowing. That's the way I have interpreted, and I didn't make that up. That's sort of my sort of compilation of what I've read about Nirvana. So is there a connection between Nirvana and the Wheel of Rebirth, or have I just given a popular, erroneous interpretation of Nirvana?
Well, Nirvana is the end of all of that.
Right, okay.
It's the end of the flowing river. It's the, because, you know, the flowing river and the creation of good karma and the development of the path, and that is all part of the goal. It's still the path to arrive at the fruit, at the result. Now, Nirvana is the result, and all it is the, you know, as I said, it's the end. It's the end of greed, hatred, and delusion. So what the mind is then, it's free from attachment, and it creates no more karma. We arrive at that not by just doing good karma, though. You cannot arrive at freedom by just doing good or by just creating karma. It has to, the only way to arrive at it, you do need a foundation of virtue and morality and right living, but that is the foundation that helps you to develop the mind through meditation, that then is sufficiently clear and focused and penetrating to be able to realize truth. It's that realization that actually frees. So Nirvana would be, having had that realization, there's the freedom from, at first, while you're still alive, there's the freedom from all what I said, greed, hatred, and delusion, all those problems, and the ability to live life without impediment, which we interpret as a compassionate life. And when that life comes to an end, what can you say? The Buddha said there is no more birth. There is no rebirth.
Yeah, you see, that's,
what had to be done has been done.
Yeah, you see, that's where I part company with Buddhism, to be honest with you. I mean, I think from a very practical standpoint, let's say theoretically somebody reaches Nirvana, and I think that, and I think I've asked this question before of a Buddhist monk, the Buddha himself reached Nirvana and he died, right? And so.
Well, one has to be rather careful. What was born died.
Right. Right.
So when you say the Buddha died, I mean, what was born died.
Okay,
what
the physical,
is born always dies.
Okay, but as a practical matter, his physical body died.
Yeah,
his physical body died.
And the mental activities.
Okay, so he died, but what you're saying is that he was something an addition to the body, and so whatever that was didn't die.
No, I didn't say that either.
Okay.
That's the problem. As soon as we postulate that, we're talking about something existing, something that stands forth. If something exists, it stands forth. It's separate. It's born and it dies. Everything in existence, born and it dies. What was born died.
Right.
Now, the question is, you know, when we say it is many people, that's why many people accuse Buddhism of being annihilationist, that we teach the annihilation. Enlightenment and nirvana is the annihilation of somebody. Now, Buddhists, you know, is that true? Well, the Buddha rejected that, but as to why, he just called it the cessation.
Yes.
Is there any difference between annihilation and cessation? Well, annihilation, just by the sound of the word, implies that there was something, somebody annihilated, whereas cessation just implies that something, a process, came to an end, and that's it. So nirvana is the process of birth and death, the process of conditioned existence, the process of that the Buddha defined as incomplete. It's flawed. It's not. It's that's, you know, normally rendered as suffering, but that's not a very good rendering. Let's just call it, it's hollow and flawed. It's just basically flawed. That's, that process comes to an end because there's no longer any attachment to it, no longer any with, and that's all.
Well, from the Western mindset, somebody reaches nirvana, that individual, that physical being, that person on the street, that his or her physical body will still die.
Yeah.
But the, what good did nirvana do then?
What good did it do?
What good did it do for that person?
Well, you see, you're assuming that carrying, you're like the person who's carrying, my teacher said this, you know, we're like people carrying this big, heavy rock or a big, heavy burden.
Right.
And we're carrying it and being, you know, gradually ground down by this, and we feel oppressed by this, and somebody comes and say, hey, why don't you put that big, heavy rock down? And you say, well, if I put it down, I'll have nothing left.
Right.
And so, you know, it's just the idea is that you're putting value on the realm of birth and death as something really, as long as you want, as long as there is value for it, as long as you value it and identifying and attaching to it, that's why you keep on being reborn. You ask for more, you get more. That's fine. Now, the enlightened person is one who's seen it for what it is. That's all. And all passion, all desire for it, all clinging to it, all identification for it has been removed. Have they gained anything? Well, they don't have a rock to carry, is what they're free. And what are they free? What are they free from is the realm of birth and death. Now, as long as it's such a, you know, we just are not enlightened because we are infatuated by the realm of birth and death, and we don't see it as unsatisfactory, and we don't see it as a burden. Yet, I do believe that at a deeper level, we know that it's unsatisfactory because that's why we're continually seeking for happiness.
Well, you know,
we're continually trying to be happy.
Yeah, and I think that, I mean, we're going to have another one of these conversations because we are basically at the end of our time, and there's a lot more questions that I have because things are just starting to get interesting here, because one of the perspectives here that we haven't gotten into is the time context. Or the era that these religions or these belief systems originated, where the Buddha 2,500 years ago, had this experience, and he was in a different culture, different era, and perhaps the best that he can do at that time in accessing the inner world was to see that the goal was to escape the wheel of rebirth, to end this attachment to the impermanent. I think from the Western standpoint, and maybe this is a different religion, or a different perspective. And I don't want to call it religion. Different perspective, different worldview. Maybe the ultimate goal might be to do both, to detach yourself from the impermanent, but to escape the wheel of rebirth by extending the life on Earth, and so that's a much more radical perspective, but I think that the area of Buddhism is so rich, and I wanna ask you one more question before we have to close here, and that is, if you in all your times of training, and you've been doing a lot of teaching on Buddhism, yoga, meditation. What is the one message that you have found resonates most with the Western mindset? What have you found to be your most successful Buddhist teaching that resonates with people?
I would have to say that for a start, being completely honest. So that if I don't know something, I can say, I don't know. Yeah. This is what the Buddha taught, but I can't, to present it with complete honesty and to present it as a challenge. Well, we don't know, at least open up to that, and let's find out.
Yes.
And the way to find out, there's some of the things we can do. And the one thing that we can do that people really resonate with and are very interested in is meditation.
Yes.
Because, people do appreciate, I think, more and more that intellect and thinking is a two-edged sword. It's very useful and it's served us well in many areas. It's done a lot of harm as well. But on a personal level, it's also becoming extraordinarily oppressive. Most
yes.
people feel very stressed and anxious and for a good part of the time, and that's self-imposed. So meditation as a way of regaining a balance of inner peace and some inner, you can say, sanity or inner well-being. And that maybe if we can cultivate the mind, train the mind in another direction of just clarity and focus rather than trying to arrive at understanding through just thinking, that we can begin to have penetrating experiences at a different level than just concepts and ideas about ourselves and religion or spirituality. So I find people respond to that very, very well. One is being completely open and honest, and I really don't like to cloak any of the teachings in terminology or anything like that. It can be expressed in plain English. And meditation is the one thing that, people really see the benefit of. And I think it's the one thing that can lead us beyond the jungle of concepts, views, and opinion.
Well, you've definitely lived a very rich life, and we may have to have a part two of this because a lot of areas we didn't cover, but I want to thank you for your time, John. It's been very enlightening, and I hope that the listener learned something about what Buddhism is all about. We know that one of the hallmarks of modern science is experimentation, but their experiments occur out in the physical world with things and equipment and stuff. Well, there's an experimentation you could do inside of yourself. The tool is meditation. You may see different worlds in there. The terms of Buddhism and other religions, these are not mystical concepts hidden away on forgotten books on the library shelves, but some of these teachings. They're deep, they're old, but they may also be true. And if they are true, then it may do us good to pick up a book on meditation, maybe John's book on the path of, I think it's called The Meditative Path from Quest Books. Pick these books up, try a meditation class, see if there is a truth inside there somewhere for you. You never know. There might be some deeper meaning that may enrich our lives. This is Philip Mirton, and you've been listening to another conversation beyond science and religion. We'll see you next week with the first of our two-part shows with Amit Goswami. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Conversations Beyond Science and Religion with Philip Mirton. To find out more about Philip and his new book, The Heaven at the End of Science, visit heavenattheendofscience.com.